Welcome to the ProWrestling.net All Access Daily Podcast for Wednesday, November 30th, 2016. I am Jason Powell, and it is my pleasure today to be joined by Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins frontman, also a TNA would-be investor, and we will be talking with Billy Corgan for roughly 45 minutes today, asking him a wide variety of questions. If the audio sounds a little rougher than usual, we are kind of going with an old-school method, just what worked best for Billy Corgan, so hopefully it came out okay. But coming up after the break for non-members, my interview with Billy Corgan. Okay, everybody, I am here with Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins frontman. Do I call you William Corgan these days? I guess we should start there.
Well, it's like Billy's kind of become my gimmick name, so we'll just go with Billy.
It sounds good. I kind of want to start at the beginning, and the way my brain works, I'm sure we'll bounce all over the place, but I'm going to do my best to kind of keep us on track, and there are going to be a few things I'm sure we'll leave out because of just time restraints, but let's go back to April 27, 2015. It was announced that you would join TNA as a senior producer. At that point, were you interested in making any type of financial commitment to the company, or was this really just you legitimately being brought in to work in that capacity?
Well, it's a bit convoluted, as a lot of this story is, but it starts with, and I'd been in contact with Dixie Carter for years, so it wasn't unusual that I would hear from her every once in a while. She'd sent me a message, and I called her, and she was, I believe, at her parents' ranch in Texas, and said, "How would you like to come on board and work on the creative team?" I'd been in independent wrestling for a while, as some people know, and I'd sort of washed out of that situation. I'd gotten a reality show made for AMC, and then that got canceled before it even was finished filming, and blah. So I thought I was kind of done with wrestling. So it was kind of strange to get this call, and I remember hanging up the phone and coming in to tell my girlfriend, I just got offered a job by TNA, and she said, "Doing what?" So in the beginning, it seemed to be a legitimate opportunity to be part of the booking staff, and I'm not overly conscious at this point in my life of what people say. Maybe I'm a little bit more conscious of wrestling just because I don't have as much tenure in it, and I saw where it was sort of treated as a bit of a kind of a shrug or, okay, what's this now? Not really at that point understanding some people's attitudes towards the company, even though I'd paid attention through the years. But I took it, and from the beginning, and I think the fact that I'm still in business with David Lagana, who was, one of the lead writers and has left now to work with me, I think that shows that I was serious about, working for the company and participating creatively. So I came in very much like I've got a job to do, and my job is to improve this company whatever way I can.
How quickly did that change?
In terms of?
Was it an attempt to kind of bring you into the fold with the hope that you would buy into the company, provide some funding, whatever the case may be?
Well, at the risk of getting out of sequence here, as you said, we can jump around a bit.
Absolutely.
Later on, I found out, and it was admitted to me, that I was not brought in to be part of the creative staff just on the face of, let's hire him because he's going to help the product creatively. I was brought in as a chip to play to try to maybe have some leverage to get a different network deal down the road.
And who confided in you, if you can say?
I'd rather not say.
Sure.
On that regard.
I didn't know if that was Dixie saying, admitting it to you, or if it was just somebody else. But
she had a way of admitting to things later without even realizing she was admitting to them. So you can definitely say that she definitely added to the veracity of what I was told. To be plain spoken about it, because I don't really have much to hide. I think I was brought in as a chip to play, particularly with MTV. I think the hope there was the Destination America situation was already going south, and as a sort of kind of advance bulwark against what are we going to do if we're going to lose this deal, I think it was seen as I was sort of a chip that could be played with particularly M2. And going back to Dixie for a second, that conversation that where it was eventually admitted to all that, she laid out a strategy that included all the people that she had targeted for different networks So, I mean, she had everything from BET to the country channel. I can't remember what, CMT. So she had strategies laid out in her mind of where they might need to go and who would help them get there. So that was sort of what was sort of admitted to me. I was sort of the chip on that regard. But again, just to give myself a little cover, as far as I was concerned, I didn't really care because A, I didn't think I was that much of a chip to play, and B, I was taking my job seriously, so it didn't really matter to me. Looking back now with everything that happened, of course, it's, you know, it's sort of it's sort of telling of the where it was going. But at that point, I just took it as just another sort of blip on the TNA radar.
So at that early point, what are you doing with TNA, you know, early days on the job?
Well, it, you know, one of the first things I said and made clear was, look, I can't sacrifice my musical life for this, but I'll give you everything I have outside of that. And it actually ended up working out here and there where I would change my music schedule to accommodate the TNA taping schedule. So my job essentially broke down to helping book the shows and then being involved on site during tapings as far as creative producing segments. And the more I got into that, the more responsibility they gave me as far as filming. And then I got very into character development, particularly with people like Decay. And started taking real possession of the product, and you know that happened fairly quickly. And I think, as much as some people in wrestling don't want to give my skill set credit for wrestling, I think all my years of being in the entertainment business and particularly shooting music videos and stuff like that, all that really came into play when I found myself sort of at Universal in a corner with talent trying to negotiate. Okay, I've got 10 minutes. How am I going to get the best out of the situation? It really, you know, I've made 30 music videos. I mean, those experiences really came in handy.
And was talent receptive, or was it kind of a bit of a mix in terms of here you have that experience, but you don't have the actual wrestling experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think looking back in the beginning, I was a bit bewildered because I was very kind of, I'm just here to help guys, you know, maybe a little bit nerdy. And there were some people there that eventually left the company that were not as receptive to what I was offering. And that was a bit difficult because I certainly respected the talent. And they kind of treated me the way you would think an outsider would be treated in wrestling. But that said, when those talents left and other new talents came in, maybe because they were green or they wanted an opportunity, they found not only working with me to be productive, but they also found it got them on television. You know, in essence, my segments and the things I was producing started getting more and more airtime. So it became, I guess, in essence, to answer your question in the best sense of the word, I had to prove that what I was doing was worthwhile. And once I did, talent really started to gravitate towards me because they started seeing that I was getting results, not for myself, but for them. And I was very happy to play a supplemental role because as I often told talent behind the scenes, you know, I don't need wrestling to prove myself. I've already proven myself somewhere else in the world, so I'm here to help you. And once I established that communication and that credibility with talent, and I think talent, you know, they do talk to each other. Once that sort of got around, the atmosphere around me changed very, very quickly, and I would say that probably kicked in about 6 months.
What were your early impressions of Dixie in terms of working with or for her? I mean, there's a big difference between whatever the dynamic was before with you guys, whether it was social settings or just phone calls, whatever the case may be.
Right. I think I had one impression before I went to work for the company, which is very much the public impression she likes to put out of, you know, person in charge or whatever. Once I got behind the castle walls, I realized that she had very, very little to do with the product. And, I mean, some people would argue that's a good thing. But what surprised me was how little connection she had to what was going on, not only to the booking, but to the results, to the ratings, to corrective measures. It very much appeared to me to someone who wanted to feel like they were in charge. There were sycophants around her that wanted to give her the impression she was in charge. But once you actually saw the day-to-day running of the company, you realize she had very little to do with it. So you start to, in that situation, and don't forget, I mean, I consider her a friend before I entered the company. So,
right. As
if you think of somebody in a friendly term, your first thing is not to spin on a dime and say this person doesn't know what they're doing. You kind of graduate into an opinion. But I was very surprised even early on at how little she had to do with the day-to-day operations of the company. And at some point you start to connect the dots and say the reason this company is in the position it's in is because this person really isn't paying attention. And that started to really change my opinion as far as what I was being told and what I believed, and then what I started to figure out for myself, which obviously gets very convoluted.
I know one of the perceptions of Dixie that I've just, not even perceptions, just I've heard this from so many people, is that she can't wait to deliver good news. If there's bad news, she hides from it. Was that apparent to you?
Yeah, I think I mean, this is a very, very small thing, and I use it to illustrate the point. I had to fight very, very hard to get segments like The Final Deletion made. I had to really push behind the scenes, and she was probably the biggest person fighting against change, which to me was insane because every indication from numbers and everything on down, I'm talking about network numbers, would indicate that you need to change. I mean, it's like, you know, it's the classic NFL thing, like fire the head coach or install a new offensive coordinator. Do something, right?
Right.
So once we saw, and she was, even after she saw The Final Deletion, or the first segment with Matt and Jeff, she was sort of against it, had to be fought hard by creative to let it continue. Then once it became kind of the cause celeb that it became, she released some sort of weird statement, or she had some surrogate plant stories in the dirt sheet saying it was her idea. And that's one of those things where you stand there and you say, you know, because you're standing there, you know exactly the way this played out, and you're like, wow, this is the person I've always heard about. And now I'm experiencing it firsthand. So I think there's truth to that from my own experiences. As one famous talent that was in and out of the company occasionally told me, you know, it's a toy that her daddy paid for. And I always, whenever I would hear stuff like that, I always kind of would think, well, it's not quite like that. And actually I would say now that's basically how it was when I was there. It was very much like a toy that, you know, like somebody picks up and they want it to be shiny and fun, and then when they get bored, they throw it aside and they don't really care about what happens to the people involved when it gets tossed aside. And when you deal with that in the day-to-day ground level, when you're there during a hurricane and she's split, you know, and leaving all the talent and crew, you know, while there's a hurricane going on, I mean, it's moments like those where you go, wow, this person is really not fit to lead.
When did your relationship with her start to change? As far as was it still in the first 6 months, even year? Were you still on good terms? Were you able to have open dialogue, or was she just so removed that you really didn't see much of her?
That's a tough question to answer simply, but I'll put it to you this way: if you were to draw a line between the time I entered the company and the time I started investing, so let's call it like before I invested and after I invested, I kind of had one opinion, which was a slowly kind of diminishing opinion of a person that I didn't have a lot of respect for, based on the opportunity and the impact that her laissez-faire attitude had on the talent. But as far as I was concerned, I kind of looked at it like, well, don't really need her around to do this stuff anyway. We're doing it. We felt the product was improving. We started to see some indications of people believing the product was improving. Of course, Pop TV also created a new atmosphere that was much more positive than Destination America. So you're sitting there sort of going, okay, this is getting better. Doesn't really matter that she's not that connected to it. In fact, you could argue it's better she's out of the way. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't have conversations with her where I would push for certain things. I'll give you a classic example that predates my investment. You know, obviously needing revenue was a constant issue before, you know, Anthem now taking over. And so I would pitch various ideas that I thought would help generate revenue. One of which was a rebranding explosion. Since it was a show we were already filming, and as anybody who's watched it, it's basically just a content show. We don't do any angles. It's just we run matches out. And a lot of times we would run talent out there twice a day to do an explosion match, and you're thinking, well, this is kind of a throwaway. We're throwing EC3 out against, you know, Bobby Roode. I mean, what's the point if you're not even going to do anything with it? So I pitched her on the idea of rebranding it as a kind of a developmental model, similar to an NXT, much different though, but similar idea in that we could build new talent. Our star talent could appear on the show, but maybe they wouldn't have to take bumps. And then the idea would be we would go to Pop and try to sell them on actually picking up the show. So I talked to her about it at length, had to kind of get it through the approval process, which anybody knows the TNA office at that time, it was not necessary. There's no straight line there, like who was really making the decisions at times. Again, this is before I invested in the company. I spend time writing a pitch. I send it to her. I send it to everybody involved. Great. You know, months and months later, after I've invested and now I'm in contact with Pop TV, I ask them whatever happened with that, and the guy's like, I never got the pitch.
Oh, my.
Never even sent it. So why did I go through all that to try to bring in revenue to develop a property for the company,
right,
if you're not even going to – and it wouldn't be like she would call and say, this isn't acceptable. I don't think we should send this. It would be like, oh, I'm going to send this, and then – you know, 6 months later, you find out it was never even sent. So then you're like, well, what was that even all about? Was it just to kind of make me think I'm doing something? It was very strange.
Did you feel like you had more communication with her than the other creative team members because you're Billy Corgan, because she brought you in to...
No, I think it's difficult in the course of an interview like this to explain that, you know, look, 2 weeks before I filed my lawsuit against the company, I was at her house sitting out and back with her by the pool. I mean, I had a personal relationship with her that predated my coming into the company. I would visit with her. I've had dinner. You know, when I was in Dallas once, I went over to her parents' house, had dinner. I'm not trying to oversell it, but what I'm trying to say is there was a sort of a personal touch to my relationship and or communication that didn't feel like I'm this guy and you're this person. It felt like just two people with common interests trying to figure out a way. And because of the sort of the way you've postulated this sort of positive news person, she's always selling you on, oh, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And so it's not like you're having these dreary conversations. You're having a lot of hope spot conversations about, oh, so-and-so called and they want you to do this and so-and-so is interested in this. You know, so you're sitting there, you're sort of trying to figure out what's real, what's not real. So I hope that makes some kind of sense.
It does. But before we get too far ahead, I do want to ask, what changed in 2016, the move to Pop TV? Everything was kind of a cluster in 2015 toward the end for various reasons, but it just seemed like the creative direction dramatically improved in 2016, and you were involved in that process, and so I'm just curious, what changed?
Again, hard to distill simply. I feel that I was able to, over time, gain enough credibility in the booking side and particularly in the production side that I felt that some of the ideas that I was bringing to the table started to click. And then it just became kind of one of those things, like people couldn't tell me no because what I was doing was working. So it's hard to, but again, even my buddy, sometimes Vince Russo, when I see him kind of get criticized for, you know, I did this and I did that. And the reason I kind of understand the criticism at times is because when you're in a team, it's not like one person's making all the difference. I felt like I was making a difference, and I started to win over the people I was working with the ideas I was having, and they started to not only go along with the ideas, but not bring their own ideas to the table that were going along with that. So we all started to kind of pick up kind of a momentum. And I would really say, I think also where the real credit is I think that roster clicked. Whatever that roster was at the, you know, spring of 2016 or whatever, that roster really started to click internally. It was sort of like an up-and-coming football team. You could just see the chemistry was there. The leadership was there, the faith in one another. People were bending way over backwards to put on better matches than they should. I felt there was a sort of a there was a sense of there's some momentum here and maybe we can get behind this product. And I like to think that I was sort of part of that belief, you know.
At what point did you start hearing about either Anthem or Aerolux?
You know, honestly, I didn't pay much attention. It only got complicated when it came to the part with me investing money. Up to then, you know, I knew that Ron and Don Harris were involved with the production company. At times, they seemed like they were TNA employees, but then other people would say, no, they work for this other company, and it was like, what's the name again? I would hear Jason Brown, who runs Aerolux's name, and you would never either see him or he was never introduced, so you didn't even know who this guy was. It was a bit like, oh, they're the people that do that stuff. Fight Network, which is, Anthem is the parent company of Fight Network.
Right.
So in Dixie's parlance, she would more often say Fight Network, and she would often talk about how Fight Network at the end of the day might be the best partner for the company, and various ideas and scenarios were pitched in regards to them. But again, it's like trying to decipher a child's drawing. You know what I mean? It gets so complicated, and there's so many different sort of swerves and angles in this story, some of which I can't legally talk about. But it's like I said, for me, it was like they were the production people. You'd say hi, how you doing? You know, that kind of stuff. But it wasn't part of the. They were just names that would get mentioned amongst many other names that were mentioned in regards to possible investment.
At what point did you realize, yeah, there's some serious financial issues with this company? I mean, there's...
Oh, from day one.
Okay.
I mean, from day one. I mean, you can, I go back to my 30 years in entertainment. I mean, you can tell when there's money and when there's not money. And right away you can tell there's not money.
And so was she forthcoming about this? Would she be open in discussing that with you because of your friendship at the time?
I guess this gets somewhat into the legal part of the case, but it's like if somebody tells you that things are funky on a scale of 1 to 10 and they say it's kind of a 4 and you take them at their word and you don't think that, you know, a meteor is going to crash on Earth and everyone's going to die, then you sort of kind of move at that pace. If I'd known it was much more serious, which was obviously the foundational root of my legal case, then it would have changed a lot of my perception. So I think I need to say that sort of from the beginning. I was operating sort of on what I was being told, which is, yeah, it's bad, but it's not that bad.
And at roughly what point were you approached about investing in the company?
Well, I was. It was sort of thrown out there at different times that I could help, and I'm saying help in quotations. I'll give you one scenario. There was one time where they were sort of riffing about the UK tour and how the UK tour wasn't going to be strong. And I mean, this is laughable, and I hope people can respect why it's laughable. They wanted to know whether I would be willing to go over and open the shows musically. Like with a guitar in the ring kind of thing. Like
kidding.
No, I'm dead serious. And I mean, when you're, I'm going to be overly simplistic for the sake of conversation. When you're working with talent who are hurt, you know, a broken finger here and a poked eye here, and they're busting their ass, and you feel the company starting to click creatively, and you start to feel sort of there's a credibility there in the overall wrestling world as far as where the product is going, and you feel good about that. And then you turn around and you have somebody that's supposed to be steering the ship asking you whether you'll don a guitar and get in a ring so that you can sell more tickets, and you're like, it's almost like, do you realize I still have a music career and how that would kill my music career? It's like you're dealing in levels of surreality. And that's where this starts to get really weird. And I can't exactly pinpoint the date. I've been told that at the beginning of 2016, word went around the office that they had to sort of target me to get money out of me. That I was sort of the backstop on where the company was going financially.
And how were you approached in terms of the first time you agreed to do this?
I don't really remember because I think in the beginning when it was first tossed out there, I so blew it off that it didn't even register. it was sort of some kind of loan scenario. And I said, look, I'm not interested in being a lender, which of course is kind of funny because I, at the end of the day, I was called a predatory lender by Dixie Carter, you know, literally, in the lawsuit. So it's kind of laughable because in the beginning I said over and over again at different times, whether it would be over a dinner when these things would be kind of thrown. And again, if we're talking kind of carny here, it was being approached as sort of a, hey, you know, over a bite of salad. Hey, would you ever consider being a part of, which of course takes me back to sitting at a diner with Paul Heyman in 1999 or 2000 and him pitching me on buying ECW.
Right.
You know, very similar scenario, like, how would you feel about being, and, you know, I'm very sensitive to the idea of the money mark, and, you know, I've heard all these things through the years as I've participated in professional wrestling, and I've certainly had wrestlers that I thought were friends hit me up for money, and I've been through all those kind of weird scenarios. So my first reaction was like, hell no. You know, I don't really think this is a business I want to be a part of. And so that's where this sort of, that's where that starts, to answer your question.
Well, what changed? Because obviously you did end up providing loans, or, you know, with the option of turning that into 36% equity at some point.
Right. Okay. Well, let's back up on that a little bit.
Sure.
One is I became more and more aware of the internal dynamics. I started paying more attention. Maybe I started asking more questions, and I started to realize now. And there's an asterisk here, which is, this is all based on what I thought where I thought the company was financially, not what I eventually found out. So, you know, it's sort of like having one hand over an eye. It's like I only saw half the picture, but the half the picture I saw, I started thinking, you know, if I could put my foot in the door in this way and lead to here, and I did target the idea that I could eventually take over the company as president. Between conversations I had in the entertainment business, conversations I had with talent, I started to see an opportunity, including conversations I had with Pop TV. People started saying to me, if you can take over the company under situation X, Y, and Z, we would get way, way more behind the company because we don't trust the way she's running the company. So I started to kind of get this sense from people like, we think you can lead, and if you have an opportunity to, we would encourage that because we all think it's going to be better for us. So there was a sort of atmosphere around me that was like, kind of opened the door to my mind of, I think I can do this. It's not financially impossible. It would be a bit tough, but I think I can get from here to here. And I'm used to dealing with big budgets and, you know, big deficits and stuff like that. So it wasn't anything that freaked me out. So that kind of opened the door. And then to get to sort of the more to the heart of your question, then when it came time, I knew they were going to come knocking on my door. Okay, here they come knocking. Now it's like, now I want real information. And this is where we begin, let's call it the litigation phase. This is where I started being presented notions and ideas and numbers which were not true, which induced me to want to put my foot in the door in a way that would kind of give me an out, which is why I kept my money from being converted to equity, as opposed to just jumping in and buying a piece of the company. So that's sort of what starts all that.
And at what point was this? Because, I mean, there was all the talk is that had it not been for you stepping in, there would not have been tapings.
That's absolutely true. That is 100% true. It literally, I'll give you a scenario. I'm standing on a street corner, and I'm on a phone with three lawyers and my manager, my rock and roll manager, who's, you know, was very helpful with all this stuff, literally yelling at me, telling me absolutely, under no circumstance, do this deal. And I'm telling them, A, why I want to do the deal, which would be repeating to you what I just repeated, but also telling them that if I don't put the money in, the company's going to go under. So that's absolutely true. To use the wrestling term, work there. That is absolutely true. The company was absolutely, trucks were not going to roll, because I know who I wrote the checks to. So, but there was kind of a, and this thing, this would be a repeating story if we went through every detail.
Yeah.
There was sort of a 3-week dance that led up to my putting in the money. So again, if somebody's trying to kind of carny you for money, their first approach is not going to be, oh my God, I'm super desperate, I need money. If you don't put money in, the company's going to go under because they don't want to give up their leverage. So they're going to come to you and say, what do you think about putting in money? Scenario one, scenario two, scenario three, scenario four, scenario five. So between extracting information, you know, assessing the situation, I made the determination to invest, which kind of opened the door towards either way to back out of it. And this was indicated in the lawsuit that the initial loan I made, she signed for. So at the very worst in that initial loan, if the company had gone under or the whole thing had blown up, she was on the hook for the money, and I figured, well, the Carter family can definitely afford it. So I didn't feel that much risk round one. So that pretty much sort of sets up that scenario. But anyway, I'd just be repeating myself. That's the general.
Well, so in each case, the loan was registered as being to Dixie rather than TNA.
No. That was just portion one. After that, then it got more complicated. And there's a lot of stuff in there I can't talk about. But essentially, in the story part of it all, you know, there were three different overtures to me. You know, we need this. Can you do this? Back and forth, negotiating. And every step of the along the way being misled as to the situation. And then as I went along, finding out that I was being misled, which is where it starts to get really, really more complicated, and that goes to the lawsuit stuff.
At any point, as you made the multiple loans to the company, did your management lawyers ever change their tune? Did they ever start to say, you know, this might not be such a bad investment, or was
no,
it always
never.
Get away?
No, they told me up and down, horrible investment, do not do it. So I went against, you know, I went against legal advice to make the deal, which really kind of sets up how it all ended up, because in order to make what was the third loan, my lawyer insisted on making sure that we were covered every way to Sunday, which is where suddenly I became, quote unquote, a predatory lender.
The loan shark.
Yeah, I was a loan shark, which is really funny because, you know, I'll give you one example. The company didn't pay my salary. I drew a, you know, a modest salary from the company as a producer. They didn't pay my salary at one point for over a year. So I worked for free for a year.
Wow.
You know, so it's a bit weird when you've got somebody on a stand, you know, calling you a predatory lender when you're like, you know, I don't remember you standing in the corner with the K, you know, on Sunday when everybody's tired and we've filmed seven shows in 5 days and everybody's dragging ass. You know, I don't remember you standing in the corner with me handing me a cup of cocoa. You know, that's the kind of stuff where it's like, that's where the emotional part and the fight part comes in, because my interest in the company was to not only continue the company, but I also thought the company had a future, and I had, you know, I certainly had plans, I had ideas, and I found myself in a situation where during that third loan phase, we basically set it up and said, look, the only way we're going to put in money this time around, we weren't stopping her from going and getting money from anybody else.
Okay.
It wasn't, does it make sense?
It does. So it wasn't like you were looking to take over the company from the first loan.
No. It was very much like, look, we're going to dip our toe in the water. Okay, now we're going to go a little bit deeper. The third time around, it was like, okay, just like anybody else, if we're going to put in this much money and we're going to require this much risk against the company, that the more we investigated, the more, like literally every time you picked up a rock, you found another scorpion, which, you know, was borne out by all the lawsuits that have been filed since I filed. I think, what, if five lawsuits been filed since I filed? So as we found out the true situation of the company and we found out how we'd been misled, that had everything to do with, like, okay, now if we're going to come in for this last round, now I've got to run the show and I've got to have institutional control.
Well, in August, you were named company president. Was that the second or third loan at that point?
That was the third, yeah.
That was the third. Okay. And you were said to be in control of day-to-day operations.
No, I that's the thing. I was legally told I was in control. We had all the paperwork, you know, that you would want to have, other than sort of an employee agreement or something like that. And the minute I had that, I mean, literally from the minute I had that title, she started working to undermine my ability to run the company.
How so?
Decisions were ignored. Employees would ignore directives and defer to her. She started going, you know, literally behind my back and making other directives. People started to get confused, and they would call me and say, who's really running the company? And I'd say, well, I am. And they'd say, well, not according to Joe or Larry or Mo. So that's where it started getting really, really funky. And that's where the situation sort of deteriorated quite quickly.
Yet at the same time, you said earlier you were having, you know, you were sitting out by Dixie's swimming pool a couple of weeks before the lawsuit was filed. So what's your relationship with Dixie at this point?
Zero.
Okay.
Yeah, I, in the kindest sense of the word, I believe the person is a sociopath. You
wow.
know, and I'm no clinical doctor, but to me, a sociopath is somebody that will tell anybody anything at any time to get what they want. So once you come to that conclusion, and certainly the way I saw the lawsuit play out and the way I was classified, you know, back to the predatory lender, ha, 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 I mean, there's absolutely no relationship there. I don't trust the person. I wouldn't hand them my car keys, much less a cup of lemonade.
Do you feel like, your lawyer insisted on having all of this different protection. When it came to the actual court hearing, the chancellor ruled against you guys, essentially saying it wasn't legal, it wasn't framed right within the state of Tennessee. Was that just a mistake, and do you think you would be in control of this company right now had things been worded differently or done differently from a business sense?
Those are two complicated questions, so let's try to take part one. Let's remember that the reason the chancellor ruled against me was they got by on a technicality.
Right.
So, now this is my reading, so this is, you know, I'm a punter, so let's just take my reading on it. So you have a lawyer who's, you know, a Tennessee lawyer who signed a document and then goes in front of a judge and says, we can't be held liable to the document that we signed and we told our client to sign because it's illegal in the state of Tennessee. So they fostered an illegal agreement and they were able to get out of the agreement by saying it was illegal.
Wow.
So to me, that's laughable on its face.
Yeah, that's something else. I didn't even realize that he had signed off on the whole thing to begin with.
Well, it was the same firm, so you know.
Sure.
But again, you know, it's very interesting. It's like obviously we're counting. You know, judges count on lawyers to be representatives of the law. So my California attorney counted on the Tennessee lawyer to tell us if we were doing something. And at no point was it indicated to us that we were entering a quote-unquote an illegal agreement. That's the point where they should have pushed back and said, this isn't legal or we can't do this.
Right.
Let me point out one other thing, as long as we're sort of, you know, openly litigating here for a second. I mean, she signed the document.
Right.
You know what I mean? Nobody put a gun to her head and said, you must sign this document to continue the company. She had every option to get the money from somewhere else or, you know, fold the company or sell to some, you know, I mean, it was sort of, here I was the person who'd saved the company for 3 months in a row. Now I'm the bad guy and I'm the one who is killing the company. So to your other question, as far as taking over the company, knowing what I know now, I think the best people ended up taking over the company.
Really?
Yeah, because they're invested in it for their own reasons. If I knew what I found out in the end from the beginning, I never would have invested at all, nor would I have put myself in that position, not only privately but publicly. So, I mean, yeah, in a magic world, would I have liked to end up running the company because I believe in the roster and the people I work with? Absolutely. Do I think I could have done great things with the company? Absolutely. But that said, knowing what I know now, Anthem's the people who stepped up and took those issues on and you know, and obviously have negotiated a settlement with me. So I'm cool with it all.
Well, very good. And I guess the big question I always had, and it's a question that I still have for Anthem, and obviously you can't answer for them, but from your perspective, what was it that you were buying had you ended up in control of this company? I mean, it just seems like there's the tape library, there's whatever other small assets there are. That was kind of the confusing part, was just trying to figure out what everyone is fighting over. This company seems to be struggling to the point of almost no return.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but I would say that everybody who was interested in buying the company, and there might have been people that were interested that I never even heard about because so much was hidden from me.
Right.
Which, by the way, was not only unjust, but, you know, possibly illegal. but that said, everybody that wanted the company had their own reasons for wanting it. So I can't speak for their own reasons. I think Anthem, through their press releases, has sort of indicated, and again, I'm not trying to speak for them, but it seems to me that they're after sort of an over-the-top network model similar to a WWE or a UFC model, which, you know, if they can pull that off, great. That's very 2016. I was certainly after something much, much different, but if you're asking me why I was fighting for it, having tried to start a company from scratch, I think it's very, very difficult, as many people have seen that have tried to enter the wrestling business from day one. It's very hard to start an institutional culture from the ground up. So to me, it was, what is the cost of that culture versus starting my own? And believe me, I was asked by money people, when I would go to my own people to talk about money and stuff like that, they would say, why don't you just start your own company?
Right.
Because for this amount of money that you're going to put in here, you could just start your own place. And I would oftentimes point particularly to the roster. I'd say it's not so easy to put together a roster like this, nor an institutional culture that knows how to work together. And again, I was under the belief of certain operating principles along the way that made me think that some of the people I was in business with I could trust, which turned out not to be true. So it's a little bit weird. Once it sort of went over the hill and it got really weird, well, then you're just fighting to get what's fair,
sure.
which is why I filed suit. And I do need to indicate, it's hard to put into the clearest language, but I did not waive every claim that I have. I still have the ability to go after particular people in the company. I did not waive that right.
Is Dixie Carter one of them?
You could guess that.
Okay.
So I have not given up my ability to pursue a different set of claims under a different set of circumstances. But that said, I'm really cool with Anthem. Everything's cool there, and I'm happy for everybody involved because I've always wanted the company to continue. That's why I put my heart into it.
Well, just point blank, do you plan to pursue further legal action at this time? Not against.
I don't really know. I thought about it this morning because obviously, you know, I'm talking to you and a few other people today. I really just have to kind of let the dust settle on the whole thing. It's been a very complicated few months. I when I first invested money, whenever it was in June, I never thought that I would be sitting here, you know, 6 months later, sort of going, kind of what just happened. Not only being out of the company and having no contact other than personal relationships, but sort of having gone through this whole weird whirlwind legally and publicly. It's certainly not something I welcomed.
Could you work with Anthem?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I would want to be an employee for the company under the circumstances that exist now, and that's not a negative. It's just I'm a person that would want, having done what I've done and been where I've been, you know, I would want more control because I believe that I'm capable of delivering results at a higher level, and if I have to build my own opportunity to do that, I'll do that, which is why I'm in, you know, business with Lagana right now, because we're out there talking to people who are really on the cutting edge of where we think technology and entertainment are going, and there's going to be a great opportunity there for wrestling. So whether Anthem would welcome me in or there would be some way we could work together down the road, I would be open to that. But right now I think they're probably in the same situation. They just want to probably figure out what they bought and get on with making a profitable company.
And have you had any? It doesn't sound like you've had any major conversations with them about a role.
No, I think more what I'm after is to try to figure out what I'm going to do and then go around and talk to people about whether or not that fits with what they're doing. I think it's more of a simpatico relationship involving many companies, which is kind of what I'm after, more than, let's say, the classic proprietary company where, you know, you live in your own bubble and pretend there's no other wrestling companies in the world. I think those times are changing. And I think the most obvious example of that is Brock Lesnar, you know, working for UFC while he's under a WWE contract.
Sure.
I think you're seeing now where mega opportunities to put top talent together under certain circumstances. Obviously, WWE's after a very proprietary model. It's working for them, and I'm happy to see so many people getting work. But at some point, there are other ways to do wrestling, and obviously there's a lot of independents out there. Maybe there might be a way to put everybody's head together, including Impact under Anthem, where we might all be able to do business together. So I hold no ill will against Anthem, and I hope there are business opportunities there because I certainly am very fond of a lot of the talent.
We're winding down on time here, but could you work with Aerolux? The word certainly was that things got a little personal with you and people within Aerolux. And maybe you want to shoot that down. I don't know.
Well, I didn't waive my right to go after them as well. So
okay.
We're just before Christmas. I've just come out of a major lawsuit that's just been settled. It's a bit weird to think about going back into legal action. But that said, I made sure that as part of what I agreed to, I did not waive my ability to go after certain individuals under the circumstances because, as I've indicated to you even in brief during this conversation, I was widely misled about not only my role, but what my money was being used for.
What is next? Are you interested in doing a startup wrestling promotion?
Yes and no. I think, again, it's very, very difficult. If you ask me today, I still think it's easier to work with an institutional culture that's already put together and pivot. Because I don't say this for sympathy, but every time I stick my foot back into professional wrestling, I have to sort of deal here's my favorite one. Billy Corgan, who's a major fan of wrestling, comma, blah, blah, blah. I mean, at some point, it's like, at what point do you graduate from fan to somebody who's involved in professional wrestling in a professional capacity? I still have a very robust music career. I devote a lot of my time and have devoted a lot of my time over the last 5 years, as you know, to professional wrestling in a professional capacity because I love the business and I love the people, many of the people in it. So at some point, it's like, I don't want to be celebrity guy involved in wrestling. I just want to be somebody who's involved because I'm passionate about the business and I want to contribute. I'm not in a big hurry to sort of like start my own promotion and go through the same, most people don't have the sophistication that someone like you does to understand the nuance here. You know, they see it very black and white. Why would somebody like you want to be involved in wrestling? I mean, if I have to answer that question one more time, I want to kill myself.
Right.
You got this weird dualistic existence where people like you who report very deeply and well on the business of the sport of professional wrestling sort of understand the personalities involved and the egos involved and how this kind of works at the ground level, and then you got to deal with somebody in the mainstream who looks at it as like, why do you want to run yourself into a brick wall? It's the weirdest thing in the world to do, and I'm still out there trying to explain to a mainstream crowd why I'm even involved. And then I turn back into the professional wrestling world and have to explain to some people who aren't as sophisticated as you as why I'm still standing there. You know, in essence, you know, at what point does the mark tag come off your back and you just become part of the professional wrestling establishment? So anything that I involve myself in, I want to be careful that I'm not sort of running into the same windmill.
I wonder if it's just attaining a certain level of success, and not that you haven't had it, but especially if you are venturing out on your own. If at some point that's what does it.
If that's what it takes, then that's totally fine. I mean, I think doubt is fine. I think skepticism is fine. I think where it's attached to celebrity culture, that gets boring. That's what I would call low hanging fruit. You know, like I said, When you're at Universal and you know you're shooting umpteen shows in so many days and you're dragging ass and you're tired and you're dealing with cranky talent and you've got to get a segment done because you've got to run it over and do another segment. I mean, those are the moments that really test your mettle as far as how much you love professional wrestling. You know, whether it's in your blood, and I at least like to think I've proven that much at this point. The success part is ephemeral in the sense. I can definitely point at things I was involved in and say I was part of that success and I'm proud of that. But at the end of the day, until maybe I stand on my own and say this was mine or this is mine with these people, maybe that respect that I would hope for won't come.
Final thing here. So you aren't closing the door on doing a startup, but it doesn't sound like anything is imminent. At the same time,
I would start here. I believe. I don't. as I'm looking at it now, I have a hard time believing anybody's going to beat WWE at their own game.
Sure.
Which is what I call a proprietary model, which is you have enough money and enough juice to run your own world, you know, or your own, in their parlance, your own universe. Nobody seems right now to even be close to running at the same level of juice that Vince runs at. So if you're not going to be able to compete in the proprietary model, then I'm much more interested in, well, what would be the next model, which involves technology and again, maybe aligning different forces that are on the surface disparate, but under the right set of circumstances might come together to create unique events that would attract a lot of fans and have a lot of interest and credibility, including to people like you, because maybe you're attracting a lot of that talent which is not in the proprietary universe. I think some model that works in that realm would be good. I think starting up and just running a company and trying to be the little engine that could to get to where, basically where TNA was at, which is, you know, struggling to make the bills and carry a roster and satisfy a network. I mean, I don't necessarily want to repeat that experience.
Well, and the thing I was going to bring up is it because Dave Lagana left TNA, now works with you, safe to say you are not finished in pro wrestling in some capacity?
I don't think so. But again, I think what I do want to do is I'd like to, in the best sense of the word, I'd like to be part of the future of professional wrestling. In essence, create the opportunities that are going to be the 21st century opportunities. Because as I said, right now, if you're saying what's the 21st century opportunity, you'd say it's WWE. Even the launching the new cruiserweight show. I mean, these are all new ideas. But again, under one roof, with one artistic and creative direction, there are a lot of talents in the world and a lot of different visions in the world that are not only not in agreement with that, have a completely different vision that might be more commensurate to, let's call it, a 21st century vision of where wrestling can go, as it involves branding and how you get content to consumers and stuff like that. I'm much more sort of focused on that. Whether a startup company sort of fits in that model, that's part of it. That's certainly something I'm very, very interested in. But I don't want to find myself sort of defending my turf in the same realm that everybody else seems to have to, in a world where most of the numbers are indicating that wrestling is becoming more and more of a niche culture.
Well, before I let you go, we covered a lot of ground, but there's, boy, so much more we could go over. I'd love to have you back sometime. You have an open door anytime you'd like, but is there anything, any message you wanted to get out there, any Smashing Pumpkins reunion tour announcement you'd like to make and make me famous, anything like that?
No, just to stick to wrestling today. Trust me, it's enough.
Very good. Well, hey, I really appreciate the time. I've enjoyed the conversation, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Jason. Thank you. Bye-bye.